You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Oh, Mother, speak, for the world must hear of the pain and suffering your children bear.
Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Annie and the Vets playing Mother Speak to introduce Lisa Tice, who will share her experience of war from the perspective of four decades as the wife of a war veteran. Also with us today is Tyler Boudreau, a former captain in the United States Marine Corps, author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Last week, Stephen Tice, a Vietnam War veteran, talked about his journey from severely wounded soldier to husband, father, and counselor of war veterans. We're airing Steve and Lisa's story to encourage today's veterans and their families to reach out to the communities that are on similar journeys of recovery. Stephen's show is archived on our website, www.raisingsandradio, where there are other interviews from those affected by war, from the perspectives of mothers, fathers, spouses, the troops themselves, as well as Iraqis and Afghans. Lisa Tice joined us on the phone from Tacoma, Washington, and began with how she met and married Stephen.
I met my husband when I was just barely 12 years old. He was in our home quite a bit as I was growing up, and of course, you know, this was in the 60s. He was 18. He's 6 years older than me. And I immediately had a crush on him and had my sights on him as a very young girl. I was pretty mature for my age. But when he was drafted and went to Vietnam, our family wrote a lot of letters back and forth, a lot of correspondence back and forth. And
so you were about 13 at that point.
13. He was wounded. We got news of his wounding literally the night I returned from my ninth grade prom.
Huh.
So about 3 months before I turned 15. It was kind of mystical. I knew I was going to be marrying him.
Hmm.
I just knew that he was going to be the person I married. I really... And being so young, you don't know how to, you don't know why you know that. you don't know how to build a philosophy around that knowingness. He was always somebody that, he was the person that I wanted to spend my life with. Mm. And when he returned from Yokohama, he was wounded on May 18th in 1969, and returned to the United States July 4th, literally flew into San Francisco and was taken by ambulance to Letterman General Hospital. We're in San Francisco the next day to visit him. So we were pretty much very present before, during, and after his experience in Vietnam. And when he was well enough to convalesce, to take convalescent leave from the hospital, he would come to Las Vegas and stay in our home. And eventually my very kind of aggressive flirtations apparently took hold. And we started dating, and eventually my mother gave me permission to marry him, and it was just, I turned 16 in late August and married him December 21st.
Hmm. So he was wounded at this point. He'd had his hand, he'd lost his hand in that bombing, in that mm-hmm. missile strike, but he had also lost his arm later due to infection, right?
Exactly. When we saw him at Letterman, he was in a body cast with a rod attached from the cast around his abdomen, holding his arm above his head. I think probably to help with the healing of the bone structure, and I don't know, you know, therapeutically why they had him casted that way, but that's how we saw him. When we went back home to Las Vegas, he was really not rallying, and they realized that the gangrene in his arm was not going to be going away, and that it was keeping him from really making a comeback. You know, he's barely surviving. And that's when they made the decision to amputate the rest of the arm at the shoulder.
Uh-huh. And so it didn't give you a moment's doubt about how that would work out for you or your family in the future?
I quite honestly was too young to understand the kind of suffering he was experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, in a way, that was in our favor.
Mm-hmm.
Because my love was just, you know, I was just so madly in love with him that that was all I cared about, was to have him in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And had I had a sense, I think if I'd been older and had a sense of life and death and pain, and I think I might not have been as strong a partner for him, because
mm-hmm.
I would have been crumbling too. I would have been sad for myself that he was in so much pain.
Interesting. Huh.
It's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
And I think because I didn't really have that concept secure in my head. You know, I always say, had this happened when I was in my late 20s, you know, I think the sorrows of life multiply as you get older, and you know your resilience gets challenged over and over again. I think it would have been a lot harder to be there, be available for him at the way I was able to do as a young girl.
Uh-huh.
But no, that was never an issue for me. I was just so glad to have him, I don't think I ever had a doubt that he would survive either. So that concept of life and death, really, you know, mortality wasn't really sealed in my awareness
yeah.
at that point. No.
So he came back, you were married, and he in the interview that we did with Stephen, he mentioned that at some point his anger became an issue in your marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's a very intelligent person, and he was able to, the anger wasn't really, he's a very gentle human being, and he wasn't physically angry, demonstrative with his anger. He was really very good at passive aggressive, you know,
mm-hmm.
language
mm-hmm.
that just kind of got you in your solar plexus, but you didn't know why.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't really define why you were hurting. And so his anger really came out passive-aggressively for the most part, you know, with little barbs here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd always kind of stay above the surface of responsibility for the hurt he was causing,
uh-huh.
you know. And I was pretty young and, you know, had a lot of maturing to do myself. I don't absolve myself from any, you know, complicity in some of the problems in our relationship. But definitely a lot of his issues were war-related. And when I questioned that later on, he said, well, you know, it wasn't until I got therapy that our marriage really got better. And he was right. You know, and when he dealt with the issues that he was angry about and really, you know, in a therapeutic way, our marriage changed for the better.
Hmm. And that you had your first child 3 years after you were married.
Mm-hmm. We were married December 21st, 1970, and Matthew was born May 13th, 1972.
Uh-huh. And but the anger was beginning to show up and affect the family dynamic at that point?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's just a lot of issues, and, you know, we were fighting more than we were getting along, and a lot of tension. And of course, we were both young still,
yeah.
too. You know,
yeah.
I was just before my 18th birthday, had Matthew, and Steve was 24. So we were still fairly young, so we were dealing with a lot of issues of that people who are young deal with.
Right.
And then add to that the stressors of recovering from a combat experience and the wounding, the physical wounding.
Yeah.
There were a lot of issues there that we weren't able to define them, because people didn't really talk about that then
uh-huh.
like they do now. We didn't have access to information then. People didn't prepare. They didn't talked to Steve about the issues he might experience after he left Letterman Hospital. It just wasn't talked about.
Yeah.
So we didn't really have any tools until later on to deal with the issues that were arising.
And I think it's important to surface these things, not in terms only of you and Stephen as, you know, what went wrong for a while in your marriage, but to kind of surface them as universal things that can happen to people after the similar experiences, so that, you know, people that are listening can share this with families that may be facing the same thing, given this war on terror that so many of us are involved in. What did you point out for people to know, to recognize?
So many things come to mind. I think the biggest thing that I've learned in sort of the evolution of my relationship with Steve is that once we got our marriage back on track and things seemed to be going really well for us, and, you know, it's not that we didn't have the challenges that most people experience throughout their lives, you know, that we dealt with and moved on. He had a health crisis that culminated in him retiring at age 50 when he started experiencing a lot of pain in his shoulder and real serious pain. He said he knew he was no longer able to do his work when he'd go nights without sleep after pulling a file drawer because the pain, you know, the resulting pain was so high. And living through that and seeing him sort of regain a new baseline of health and thinking, okay, this is good, we're going to get back to where we were before this happened. We were always hoping we'd get back to where we were when he wasn't experiencing this level of pain. Never really got back to that. And it was so unexpected because he'd already dealt with so much and worked so hard to get to a level of just stability in his life. And to have this health crisis happen really kind of threw us for a loop. I think what is most difficult for us, those of us who are dealing with a family member or a loved one or even ourselves that have significant health challenges, is hanging on too hard to wanting it to go back to where it was before and not really giving ourselves the emotional flexibility to just accept that it may get better, it may get worse again, it may get better, to sort of just be present with whatever's happening at the moment, know that it can change, and try not to be too emotionally attached to expectations of life returning back to how it was. And I think especially for people who've experienced combat and are coming home and, you know, there's a new generation of soldiers and veterans and loved ones, partners and family members who are going to go through what Steve and I have gone through over the last 40 years and experience different challenges. And you know, why is my loved one not the same as they were before they went to war? Why are they not the same as they were last month? Why, you know, I think to expect to be open to the possibility that things can change and that to survive that change is, first of all, to know that that's normal, that it's a normal condition of living, and that not to let it interfere with the reason why you're with that person and the reason why you love that person, but to talk openly about what the issues are that are causing a change in behavior, causing the change in health, and work together to get through those changes and talk about, you know, okay, how can we address these challenges now? What can we do? What can we do proactively to restore any level of health, be it physical or mental, and actively work toward whatever you need to work toward? What I really want to say, you know, has to do with something that I thought of at the time we were sort of recovering from this, and, you know, and it was reflecting on this whole idea of readjustment from war. And in fact, I wrote a paper about it, that there really is, you know, that's a static idea that things are going to, you know, you're going to go through this readjustment process and then things are always going to be better because
uh-huh.
you already paid your dues.
Uh-huh.
And the truth is, they can get worse again, you know. And what was hardest for me emotionally in adjusting to them getting worse was feeling, I guess, a little bit victimized. Like, wait, why is this happening to us? He's already
yeah.
gone through too much. And that is not a healthy attitude. That makes things worse.
Now let's just talk about the current war. Mm-hmm. When you feel as though politically there's such a huge question about what on earth we're doing over there,
exactly.
And then you have, you know, someone in your family that's so badly wounded. So there is that. I mean, I'm sure that sense of being victimized comes up.
Of course.
Yeah.
I think it's a normal response. I think at some point we all feel victimized by life. The difficulty is getting ourselves out of that mindset and realizing that's not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most harmful attitude we can take is lingering in that too long, because
mm-hmm.
what it does is it creates more anger.
Mm-hmm. It feeds on itself.
It feeds on itself,
yeah.
and it doesn't facilitate healing. And I think the key lesson that I've learned all these years is to really, you know, even if it doesn't help, do what we can. Try new things.
Uh-huh.
You know, incorporate new things into your life to try to move toward healing. Because that's empowering. And at least, and you're doing something. You're doing something. You're not allowing life to control you. You're doing something to take control of your life again.
Although I like the way you use the word linger, because that assumes that, you know, you are in it, and that accepting that you're in it is also part of moving on, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's when you kind of stay unconsciously struggling with the same thing and never really getting anywhere.
Exactly. And there are a lot of reasons why we may linger there for a while. As you said, the difficulty with any war, you know, political feelings about war, the complexity of reasons why people go to war, all of those things affect our attitude when our loved ones come home wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Steve has always said, and I just love this concept, it's really important for us to develop the ability to embrace paradox.
Uh-huh. That's not a very American principle, is it?
No, we're very black and white. We have very low room for, very low tolerance for mixed views and treading that middle path. You know, in this war, I've noticed that a lot of intellectuals call it the progressive path. And I'm glad they developed a concept around it, but it is progressive to be able to honor people's experience that may be very different from your own, but also caused because that person made very different choices from the choices you would make. So, but not making them the enemy because they made those choices.
Mm-hmm.
Because how does that facilitate healing? And, you know, I'm talking about healing at a personal level, but also at a more global level. I don't, you know, we talk at each other. We don't talk with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so critical that at some point the human condition transcends this need to create enemies.
Lisa, let me take a moment and remind our listeners that you are Lisa Tice. We're talking with you today about the being the spouse of a veteran. In your case, Stephen Tice, your husband, was wounded in Vietnam and eventually lost an arm. And you have made a marriage that many people, I think, would envy. And then under the circumstances that you've done it is really quite wonderful to hear. Lisa, how has it been with your three boys growing up with Stephen? Do you talk a lot about the effects of war? Have they ever shown any inclination to go into the military?
Well, as a mother of and the wife of a disabled veteran, and I don't want to betray the service of the soldiers in our military or the family members that have supported the soldiers and had to live through what I call the real-time war, where they're literally on the phone with their loved ones or on the email or as bullets are whizzing by. Because I have a high regard and respect for the sacrifice these people are making, I have to say that I'm very grateful that none of my three sons has had an inclination to go into the military. And I really believe that is because they see up close the consequences of what combat can incur.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's not to say that we don't know a lot of sons and daughters of disabled veterans who did choose military as a career,
mm-hmm.
and specifically to go to war, you know, during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mystery to me why our sons didn't choose that path, but we always felt that if they were to choose that path, we would support whatever decision they made. I'm glad they didn't. They chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
Only because I like to keep my kids safe.
Yeah.
And this need to keep them very safe, as much as the mother can. And so, no, they didn't choose that.
Lisa, in your work as a social worker, do you come into contact with vets?
A lot, yes. Yeah. And we were in Tacoma. We have five military bases in this Puget Sound area that soldiers and veterans feed into our campus from. And so over the years, I've worked with students with disabilities, but also as a counselor and worked with active military family members and military members and veterans. And it's been interesting to see just how really rigid the military system is in terms of, I can understand why there is such a stigma to seek especially mental health counseling. During peacetime, a lot of military members did not want a record of having sought counseling and could not even take St. John's wort for mild depression, because if it was found in their bloodstream, they might it might jeopardize their military career. So one thing I am glad to see emerging is a recognition that there is a serious issue here in terms of these folks being able to get help. But it's still very complex.
On the other hand, I've heard of mixtures of pharmaceuticals that these folks are given too. Some are given, you know, medication for bipolar and depression, and there's a whole cocktail. And you have to wonder how that cocktail is working in the system too.
That's part of, I think, the new the paradigm shift with this war is that what I've heard over the years is that the military, because this is a volunteer military, will essentially take your standing, walking, and breathing to keep them there, of course, they're medicating them to keep them functioning. You know, I mean, we have the advantage of hindsight with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't have that advantage with this era of combat, and I think it's going to be the issues that we've seen with the Vietnam-era veterans are going to be compounded because of the multiple deployments, because of the nature of this war, because of concussive injuries, a lot of traumatic brain injury, undiagnosed and diagnosed. There's just too many multiple issues that these people are returning, that these men and women are returning with, that we're just to see the long-term effects of their healing process and the effects of war is going to be an interesting, and it's going to surprise us, I think.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, do you have any organizations that you would suggest would be good if certainly people are having a very hard time getting appointments at the VA? It often takes months to do that. Is there any interim thing that you could suggest, or organizations that work in this area?
Well, there are a lot of nonprofit organizations, and I unfortunately don't have the list in front of me, but we've always been big proponents of the vet center system, the readjustment counseling vet centers, and there's several vet centers in every state, and it was created post-Vietnam. Steve was in one of the first vet centers set up in Las Vegas, and in 1979, and worked intermittently throughout his career in the vet center system, and it's just a wonderful system. They're small clinical teams. You walk through the door, you ask for an appointment. A lot of vet centers are including therapists who are skilled in working with sexual trauma survivors. That's another issue in this war that's compounded from previous wars. Generally, there's peer counseling offered. Mm-hmm. You're working with therapists who've also experienced combat. And it's just a good place, I think, to help regain, first of all, to break the ice feelings of isolation, which I think are really not a good thing, to allow yourself to get too isolated.
Yeah, okay.
And it's free.
There was Lisa Tice, wife of Stephen Tice, whose story we aired last week. Also joining us on the phone is Tyler Boudreau, author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Tyler spent a total of 12 years in the Marines and resigned his commission as captain in 2005. I asked him to describe his journey from enlisted man to a leader of men.
The original attitude was when I was 16 and 17 years old as a high school student, and leading was not part of the image back then. When I was a young guy, it was just about the challenge, it was about the camaraderie, the esprit de corps, it was about the nobility of serving one's nation, but doing it in a kind of a rugged, manly way. You know, there was the esteem from my friends and from the community. I mean, you put that Marine sticker on your car and suddenly, you know, people have a whole new respect for you. There's always these stories about policemen giving you a break because they respect you. I mean, so there's this whole kind of aura of being in the military, and for me specifically being a Marine.
Mm-hmm. But you went to Iraq?
Right, I went to Iraq, but that was 10 years of active service later, and actually a total of about 14 years later from me enlisting. So I had a real change of perspective since when I first joined up. I mean, I had a lot of years under my belt, and I also had a higher level of responsibility. I had gone through 4 years enlisted, and then became an officer. And I had been an officer for about 6+ years by then. I was a captain.
Mm-hmm. You were a captain, and then in your book you write, at times you felt like a cyborg. You were part human and part Marine. Can you talk about that?
You know, I was trying to capture sort of kind of a phenomenon that happens when you're in such a total institution like the military. I mean, you know, you completely submerge yourself. It's not like just a job. You're there night and day. You go on long deployments. You might go to war. You're all wearing the same uniform. You're all following the same doctrine, and procedures are all over the place, and everybody follows them just the same way, you know, and that's the point. And when that happens, you know, I think that your consciousness really does evolve into part institution, part, you know, individual, because of that very fact. You're pushing that on yourself.
Mm. But you were quite aware of it at the time also, right? Because at one point you mentioned that you're saying to yourself, this isn't right. Stop now while you still have some of you left.
Right.
The longer I stayed, the less of me remained, the more of me became Marine, programmed through regulations.
As I go along through the Marine Corps, I mean, I become more and more immersed in, you know, in the total mentality. I mean, I just don't think that mentality really catches on to, you know, a young Marine in his first 4 years. I mean, to some, you know, it's going to be a varying degrees for each individual, fine. But I don't think that, by and large, an individual becomes really institutionalized in just 4 years. But as you spend more and more years, and that's the literature that you're reading, and that's the activity you're doing, and everything you do to succeed in your career, you know, really involves, you know, institutionalizing yourself. And I think that probably happens in other institutions as well, but I think it happens in the military.
Yeah.
But there were times, you know, I mean, I just happened to be a very independent character, and I really have always sort of been very conscious of my own identity and how the Marine Corps, you know, sort of pulled against that, you know, maintaining my own identity. And it's just something that I, as an individual, always kind of dealt with. And so I think that there were times when I would, you know, be aware of what I needed to do to myself to become an extremely good leader of Marines, you know, just totally immerse yourself all the time with these thoughts and ideas and lessons. You know, I was aware of that, and I wasn't against that. I was like, okay, you need to do this. This is what you need to do to become, you know, the great Marine.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think that there were occasions where I would say, man, you know, because we all have bad days, and sometimes I'd have a, you know, a day where I just sort of noticed how much I was paying attention to the Marine Corps, not how much I was paying to, you know, what, you know, sort of what individuality I might have brought to them.
Mm-hmm. And then how was it affecting your family at home? There must have been a, they must have noticed.
The transformation sort of thing?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, for my first 4 years, I didn't have a family, and then when I went back in, let's see, about a year, let's see, I went in 97, and 99 I got married, so... you know, it wasn't that many years.
Mm-hmm.
But furthermore, my wife is a veteran herself. She was
okay.
She was a naval officer. So, I mean, I think we're all sort of operating under the same general mentality.
One of the things that I've noticed in the United States particularly, there's not really a full understanding of what happens in war, but we send our young people off and they come back, and then there's very little discussion about what they do or, you know, how they've changed or what happened over there. Can you talk about that?
I think what you're saying is correct. I've noticed that the people in this country have never, you know, experienced a domestic war except for civil war. And so, you know, we really don't have the same understanding as many Europeans say of having their country invaded. And I think that gives a different perspective. It gives sort of a much more theoretical, sometimes utopian view of war, and sometimes an overly negative view of war. I mean, you know, I think that goes for both the left and the right. As far as political distinctions, you know, where it's the extreme. It's either the extreme worst thing ever or it's the best thing ever. You know, it doesn't seem to have any kind of place in practical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
that maybe, you know, people who had their countries invaded could have a better understanding of both the grim realities of it but also the possibly necessity of it.
Mm-hmm. There is a tendency here to think that if you're a soldier or a Marine or a warrior of any sort, from the left perspective, is that there's something wrong with you and that you need to be changed into a peacenik, you know? And so even that discussion, even within the left, is hard to have. That's real. And oftentimes the soldiers and the Marines don't really want to talk to the peace people. And so that gap remains, doesn't it?
I could see that being so. I mean, I find myself, you know, I speak to people who are opposed to the war frequently, and I happen to be opposed to the war too, but that doesn't mean that everybody opposed to the war thinks about things in exactly the same way. So, you know, there's still plenty of discussion to be had, and I find myself frequently talking about kind of the real nature of people's attitudes in the military, and it's very easy for people who are opposed to the war but never experienced the military to sort of, you know, fall under, you know, kind of general assumptions about their character and their personalities and their attitudes, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, well, it's not exactly what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't speak for the collective, you know, United States military, but I can say what I saw.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the training that the young folks go through. The Marines has the reputation for being the most intense form of training, and you get into that quite a bit in your book.
We like to say so. Which part would you like me to talk about? My being trained or training other guys?
Well, let's talk about, from your perspective now, when you're looking at how young folks are being trained and what, from your perspective of having been in there for so long and having recognized now the effect on you, how you see that unfolding for them.
I mean, there's a lot of different issues to hit on here, so, you know, I'll try to give you kind of a broad brush response. I mean, first of all, the type of training one does to oneself, you know, just personal development is a little bit different than the training that might be, you know, given to you or put upon you or whatever. And what I mean is that once an individual decides this is going to be my career and I want to make it to the top and I want to be the best Marine leader possible, once you get that idea in your head, then, you know, you start really accepting all the, you know, the real nature of battle and war and the military, because the only way you can become really good at doing it is if you have a real understanding of it. An idea that, for instance, desensitizing, you know, young people to the, you know, the ugliness of killing, you accept that. You say, okay, well, this makes sense to me. I understand what I have to do to you know, in the interest of winning the battle. This is, you know, this is what I have to do. I don't think that we use the word desensitize, but, you know, but with those things that do desensitize, we recognize them for what they are, and once you become that sort of professional-minded soldier or Marine, you accept those things a lot more readily, and a lot of the other ugliness you go, you know, you understand it, you accept it, because it's all in the interest of leading men to victory.
And it has a context, yeah. But what about the folks that come in and they want to be Marines, and once they get there, they either realize that they can't do it, or they certainly cannot do it from the point of view of what the Marines are looking for, but they remain in, they're pretty much forced to stay in.
Okay, so your question is, if somebody changes their mind once they've reached, say, training,
yeah,
and they want to get out. Well, I mean, it's true that you know, they have an enlistment contract, and so it's not like they can just say, okay, see you later, I'm walking out the door. I mean, there's going to be some resistance on the part of the military to, you know, to that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what can a person do to get out? I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, courses of action that people have taken to get out of the military, and, you know, and so that just happens. So, you know, it's not utterly impossible, but, you know, you have to take certain courses of action, and it's difficult, and the military wants to fight that as much as they can, because they understand that when a guy shows up, or a woman, you know, I only train men, when a guy shows up to boot camp, it's not going to be that pleasant for him. It's going to be kind of a shock to his system, you know what I mean? So it's very common for a recruit to say, oh, no, this isn't exactly what I was picturing. And, you know, we don't want the, you know, every person to have that thought, just walk out the door.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too common. We wouldn't have a military if that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we make it, you know, illegal for him to walk out the door, but we also, you know, encourage him through other means.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also a line in your book that goes, if the kid makes it through boot camp without slitting his wrists, he'll do okay in combat.
That's in the context of a whole discussion. I think that I say that in sort of a, you know, humorous way. I don't think that was ever an attitude that anybody would actually have. I never had that attitude, you know, in reality. But I was sort of making a point.
Yeah.
That the discussion of suicide is very prevalent on the recruit training depots. You know, and there's not always attempts, but there's always these what we call ideations, where someone says, I'm thinking about hurting myself, and then you have this whole suicide ideation scenario where we have to, you know, send them to the psychiatrist, and then they get evaluated, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bring this up because I've done some counseling on the GI Rights Hotline. Obviously, the people that call the hotline want to get out of the military. They're finding that it's just a job that they really don't want to do. And so we hear about suicides a lot, you know, that sense of being driven to desperation. I mean, you even talk about this kid that jumps out of a window,
right? That's right. That was my first week.
That was your first week?
As a training officer, yeah.
Yeah. How did that affect you?
Well, I think the way I describe it and the way I remember it is that I felt pretty much no, you know, pity for the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as I said, you know, that was a time where I was, you know, had decided, okay, I am going to be a professional soldier, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a professional Marine, which means that's the way I'm going to, you know, sort of set my my brain in motion in that, you know, in that capacity. So so when I see a guy dive out the window, you know, of course I'm, you know, we took care of him, but aside from that, I was like, you know, I just really didn't feel any compassion for him at all.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until later, you know, having the clear recollection of the moment that I said, gee, that was kind of an odd reaction to sort of look unsympathetically at a guy who just dove out the window.
Mm-hmm. But then it also puts a particular slant on how you view the Iraqis, for example, doesn't it?
What puts a slant?
going through this training, recognizing, you know, that you really want to be a Marine and that you can't really pay too much attention to the empathetic side of you.
Right.
When you take that to war, it also affects how you view the Iraqis. I'm not going to call them the enemies here. I'm going to just call them the Iraqis.
Yeah. Well, that's right. So it certainly is true that part of our ability to, you know, effectively return fire in a combat situation is to think less of the lives of the people who we're shooting. I think that's pretty well exposed fact today, so I don't need to prove that. But you know, what we don't really think about is, all right, what exactly does that mean in a counterinsurgency situation? I mean, you know, you can kind of see the plain benefit of that sort of training and mentality if you're doing a conventional World War II style force-on-force fight where you don't have to interact with people. You're just on a battlefield. But, today's battlefield is, our Iraqi neighborhoods. And there are no, visible enemy, so to speak. They don't wear uniforms or carry flags. They just, immerse themselves in the local population. And so, you're left in a situation where you don't know who's going to threaten you. And, the natural instinct is to assume that everyone is a threat. I mean, anybody in that situation where you don't know which person in the crowd is going to attack you, you act suspicious with everyone. That's what you do to survive. So now you've got this counterinsurgency situation where we're out there, we're with rifles, machine guns, et cetera, and we're looking across a crowd who we're supposed to be, developing a relationship with. We're supposed to be helping. We're supposed to, befriend the Iraqis, love the Iraqis, and all this business about winning their hearts and minds. But at the same time, we have to, in order to survive, we have to suspect everyone and view everyone as a potential threat. And so you can see right off the bat we're in kind of the wrong state of mind to be winning anybody's hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm. And is there any discussion of that amongst yourselves when you have some downtime? Do you talk about that, the difficulties?
I don't remember having any downtime in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
A little bit, not much. And I was also, a couple of factors here. Number one, I was a captain, and so you don't tend to, chew the fat with the guys all that much, particularly
right.
In critical tones about the mission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the Marines did it amongst themselves all the time. I was a young enlisted guy at one time, and, sure, everybody says whatever they want to say. As long as you're following orders with gusto, it doesn't really matter what your opinions are.
Mm.
It doesn't quite work the same way for the officers. You can't do that, young enlisted thing where you just follow orders. You've got to be in it,
mm-hmm.
Because the only way that you can really maximize your leadership of soldiers in combat is to really, have your heart in it. If you're just sort of faking it, it's just not going to work out. They're not going to respond to that leadership. So you're asking about whether or not we, might have talked about or if I even thought about it. Much of the things that I'm describing in the book were things that I noticed. Sure, I noticed them immediately, but I also noticed the trend. I mean, I didn't just come to any conclusion based on one or two experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I let these things sort of accumulate over the months that I was there, and then finally after I'm, all done with this deployment, I say to myself, well, okay, here are the trends.
If we, when I say we, the civilians in the United States, don't really understand what's happening in the military, and that if there's a communication gap, then aren't we going to be doing more of these kinds of Iraq-style combat situations?
Well, I think that I am a great believer in people understanding every bit of the war. To me, that sounds very democratic, and I'm always kind of, particularly now having not only gone through the Iraq War, but also, that professional attitude about the mission has its advantages. And one of them is that, we look at this thing dispassionately. We look at, our job as combatants dispassionately. And so, everything ought to make sense. We have no interest in concealing anything from the American people. We want to make sure that everybody understands it. If I believe thoroughly in my profession, then I also, believe thoroughly in my oath to uphold the Constitution, those sorts of things. Then I believe in democracy. You know what I'm saying? It makes sense for people to know about it,
mm-hmm.
and that everybody who was sort of considering whether or not we should employ me, the professional Marine, they should have all the cards on the table. I don't want to fool anybody into going. Yeah. I'm only interested in doing my job when the American people say, this is the time to do this job. So I don't believe in this idea of like, oh, let's not show them this and let's not show them that. I want them to see everything, not to scar them. I mean, maybe that'll help and prevent us from going to war, for sure. Maybe it'll help us only really, really engage in military action when, you know, when it's overwhelming, when the people understand like, the entire nature of it and they know the costs, and still they say, we've got to, you know.
And so do you think it happened this time, though?
No, absolutely not. It never happens. I mean, people don't understand the military and the nature of war, for the most part. It's just not exposed. What anybody knows about the really brutal nature of war is usually from history, from past wars. And I don't know, it's kind of an odd phenomenon that people, generally speaking, kind of dissociate those sort of historical images that they have, whether it's from the movies or, you know, books or whatever, from what's going on in their own current war, as though there wasn't violence in the modern war.
Mm-hmm. I did an interview with Dr. Andrew Basevich, who actually lost a son in Iraq, and his point was that there's not enough engagement with the overall population about how war happens, because not enough of the family members are involved. That is to say, without a draft, and he wasn't suggesting that we need to bring a draft back, but he was saying, you know, without a draft, it's very easy not to pay attention to what's going on in these wars.
Yeah, that certainly sounds true to me, although, the families being not involved enough, is I would take that as a statement of fact, but then I would also say, I wouldn't necessarily say, well, you know, the families just aren't involved enough. They need to get more involved. Well, I'm not sure that I would put it upon the families. From my point of view, I would say, yes, you know, families aren't involved enough. The government has an obligation to make all the people, the family, understand the total nature of the thing. Do you understand, people, when we're talking about sending, you know, U.S. troops over here, do you understand that some of them are going to come out with, you know, without their limbs? Some of them are going to come back with burned faces. Some of them are going to come back with their bodies blown apart. I mean, that's going to happen, all right? That is a reality. And you know something else? People are going to do atrocious things in war. Some people are going to be exposed to this violence. It's going to mess up their head, and they're going to do some awful things. Not under orders necessarily, but it's going to happen. It's always happened in every war. You know, people in brutal circumstances behave brutally. It happens. So, you know, that's another factor. You know, so like, Abu Ghraib shouldn't be a surprise to people. We shouldn't be stunned that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
We should know that it happens in every war. We shouldn't be fighting the fact that, you know, the guys from Winter Soldier, whether from Vietnam or for this war, you know, are exposing these stories about war. We shouldn't be like saying, oh, they're traitors. Not exactly. It shouldn't be them telling those stories. It should be Congress
mm-hmm.
telling those stories to the American people before they vote on war.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and yet that's not what we have, is it?
No. And that's what makes, if you really start to, you know, kind of ponder this thing deeply, that's the kind of thing that makes you say, I wonder why it is that they're not telling us about it. I mean, is it just that they don't think we have the stomach for war? Is that all it is? It seems to me we've as a country, we've demonstrated the stomach for war quite readily.
So what do you think it is?
Well, that's, you know, that's exactly where you start to ask yourself that question, say, well, what is this about? You know, and maybe I don't have the answer, but it doesn't seem to be about what they're talking about. You know, and as a captain, as an infantry officer, you know, we paid very close attention to mission statements and operations orders. I mean, we wrote them and drafted them and practiced. I mean, there's an infantry officer school that's like almost entirely about drafting operations orders. So it's not taken lightly. So, you know, as I'm participating in that process in Iraq, and I'm writing out these orders, and I'm carefully looking at the statements and what they mean and what they're supposed to accomplish, and then I sort of watch the operations unfold on the ground, and they don't seem to be matching up. As a professional, I get really concerned and say, well, hold on a second here. If the president is saying the objective is this, and I don't see any of this going on, maybe someone should alert him or something.
So it didn't occur to you that was sort of irrelevant.
Exactly what I would call it, irrelevant. I started to sort of become alarmed, and we're all sort of various people pointing to the shortfalls. And then after a while, I said to myself, all right, now hold on a second here. Now I'm just little Captain Tyler Boudreaux. I'm nobody. So I know that if I'm saying this, that everybody is saying it. Mm-hmm. Everybody is seeing it from, I mean, they got guys in suits that are packed into the Pentagon, into the White House, whatever. They're all, just everybody's thinking around the clock. That's all I hear about these guys is they work like 24 hours a day thinking about this stuff. So there's no way that Tyler Boudreau has found something that they haven't found. So either they don't want to see it, or they see it and they've got some other things in mind.
You know, when you're in an organization, you become the organization in some ways. And so that's a reflection of what's going on here, isn't it?
There are a lot of pressures, I'd say, on commanders at all levels to say not only that things are looking good, but also that I can do it despite adversity. That's ingrained in the culture. It's not just the culture of an I can do culture. It's also the attitude of, if I can't do, I'm getting fired, or I'm getting passed over, or I'm getting a report that might not be as strong as it could have been had I said I could do it. You know, that determination and, you know, perseverance is pretty important in the military. And then there's also that factor of becoming institutionalized. There's that weighs in as well. I mean, there's a lot of pressures and different reasons why I think, you know, you have commanders at all levels resistant to looking critically. I mean, they will look critically, you know, up to a certain point, but there seems to be this, like, invisible point that you don't pass. You don't go into the realm of questioning the mission itself.
Yet you did eventually, didn't you?
To myself, sure.
Yeah.
I never questioned anybody else.
But you have left the Marines. That's quite a bit of a statement.
Yeah. Well, I did it quietly, unfortunately, but that's what I had to do at the time.
Tell us about that process.
Well, I had fulfilled my obligations, so all I had to do was submit a request for resignation. So it really, there was nothing, there was no big to-do in my command about it. And the thing is about being a commander, at the time I was a rifle company commander, is that there's a lot of people that want to be commanders. Even when times get tough, even when the enlistment numbers are strained and they're struggling to get new people in and they have stop loss, all that. Even when that's all going on, there's no trouble getting people to jump into command. You know, there's a line of guys waiting to jump into my job when I get out, so big deal. Nobody cared.
And how long ago was that?
That was in 2005.
And how has the transition been for you?
It's been, you know, a combination of good and bad. I mean, I'm really happy that I'm out now because, you know, all that sort of individuality that I feel that has always been there has been able to kind of thrive in the last couple of years, and I don't have to hem myself into, you know, other people's idea of how I ought to behave, the things I ought to enjoy. If I want to, you know, it's not just about my daily routine. It's about, you know, feeling comfortable with certain views or pastimes or whatever it is. Whatever it is that it's about me, I could just let it come out. And nobody's going to say anything about it. But in the military, you know, you have a need to keep yourself, you know, in line with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. So how can our listeners get in touch with you, or do you have a website?
I sure do. I have, I do an online blog. It's called Deeper Than War. And if you go to www.deeperthanwars.blogspot.com, you can find it.
By calling this Deeper Than War, what are you referring to?
An idea that occurred to me, I said, you know, this isn't just, you know, all this talking about war, it's not just about the battle. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about the battle. We went to the left, we went to the right, we skirmished, we ambushed, we did all these things. You know, this talk has got to get beyond just the fight. And I think that that's what's happening even now in the news, you know, mm-hmm. all about the surge. Well, the surge is doing this, and the surge is doing that, and no, the surge, and yes, the surge. But, you know, we've really got to get to a conversation that's deeper than just on-the-ground tactics. It goes much deeper, you know. Mm-hmm. It goes deeper in the politics. It's not just about terrorism. It's not just about national security. It's not just about 9/11. I mean, there's just so much more. It involves the whole country, everybody, and I think that that's kind of where the name Deeper Than War came around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wanting this conversation to be deeper than just war.
Mm-hmm. And that's really the challenge, isn't it? I know myself, I was very reluctant when my son returned from his first deployment in Afghanistan. I was very reluctant to talk with him about it because I was afraid that he would have had experiences that I wouldn't be able to do anything about. And I think that's not uncommon, but it's, you know, we have to get beyond that. And if the troops themselves can be courageous and being sent off and doing their jobs, then we the civilians need to be just as courageous in understanding what they're doing.
Yeah, that would be nice. I don't know if civic virtue is going to be enough mm-hmm. to get this conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to have to take measures more serious than that. And I'm not sure what those measures are, but this crowd of us can all sort of chant, you need to do it because it's the right thing to do. I'm not sure that that's going to be incentive enough.
Do you see us heading in that direction now as we head into this presidential election?
Well, I'd like to say so. I hope so. Senator Obama is much more in favor of bringing the war to a close, and I think that that's a positive thing. But, I mean, at this point, there are some serious considerations, in Iraq. And as much as I just really just want it to stop because I think that there's just, we can't hold the Iraqis hostage forever. We can't do it. And that's really what the surge is to me. It's 100 guys on every block and Baghdad's on lockdown. I mean, of course there's not much activity going on. I don't think that that's a good way to keep things. I think, everyone agrees that we've got to go and what's going to happen when we go. And, gee, I'm nervous about that. And I don't mm-hmm. think either presidential candidate has a good idea of what's going to happen or a good plan for, making it go smoothly. But, to your question, I kind of admire the sort of energy that Senator Obama is generating and this thought of change, and not just change, but having a pretty empathetic look towards the world, and that's got to happen. We've got to start thinking about the whole planet, not just ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler Boudreau's book, Peking Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine, is available from his website and blog at www.deeperthanwar.com. And of course, you can also find it on other online stores. Daniel Ellsberg says of this book, "I don't know another book on any subject, let alone on war, let alone on Iraq or the Corps, that combines such breathtaking candor and self-awareness with such impressive insight and extremely good writing as well. Riveting, engrossing, simply terrific, a page-turner." And again, you can order from www.deeperthanwar.com. And that's our show for today. Views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. Have a great week, and we'll go out with Annie and the Vets and Mother Speak.
For the world must hear of the pain and suffering your children bear. If a world doesn't hear, a world doesn't care. So, Mother Speak. And your sorrow share, they will hear and they will care. Let your voices rise into the air. It may bring you pain as your sorrow share. Hide not your tears, let your words fill the air. Oh, Mother, speak, let your feelings flow like a raging river. Your anguish they must know, they will awake. As the torrent of your message reclaims this land, they will hear and they will care. Let your voices rise into the air. It may bring you pain as your sorrow. Hide not your tears, let your words fill the air.